HRNradio.com, where positive people and podcasts unite.
Welcome to the Well Mind with Dr. Mike show. This is Dr. Michael McGee, your host. And today we have as our guest Dr. Donise Worden, who is a naturopathic physician and a researcher and lecturer. And she's going to be talking with us today about alternative approaches to recovery from addiction. Welcome, Dr. Worden. It's great to have you.
Thank you, Dr. Mike. Glad to be part of the show.
Let's start by having you tell our audience a little bit about yourself and your background and how you got an interest in addiction.
Sure. So I am a licensed naturopathic medical doctor, and in the state of Arizona, I'm licensed to do everything a traditional medical doctor would do, from prescriptions to minor surgery. So we're primary care. Also licensed in homeopathy and botanical medicine, so we understand the herbs and the drugs. We're licensed in acupuncture in traditional Chinese medicine. We have a counseling degree and several others, you know, that are more physical medicine. So we really kind of cross that bridge, kind of a bridge between traditional and alternative. And where I sit is in the science end of both sides, you know, challenging and also supporting research or, you know, at least scientifically sound natural alternative treatments for many things. And today our topic is about addiction. But that's where I sit, and I do clinical research. I design and conduct clinical trials for medical devices, for nutraceuticals. I formulate, so I understand the nutraceutical side of it, and that clinical nutrition is also another license of what I do. But I do love to educate, and I do continuing medical education where I'm training physicians in a lot of therapies that are coming out of Europe that are a little bit unique and different.
Well, it's great. This is exciting. So tell us, let's start the conversation with maybe starting with teaching us about evidence-based alternative approaches to treating addiction. And I'd be interested in your thoughts about detoxification and about craving management and about well-being and dealing with stress systems, anything that you might have to share. Start us off.
Right. Well, you know, I will say some of the ones that, you know, when I looked, I was looking at your book, and I cannot wait to get it and read it. I'm very interested in, I will say bravo to you for your topics. I'm not going to go into the meditation or the mindfulness type things because I think you've covered that very well, and you probably have in other aspects. But there's a lot of research. We know meditation and what that does, getting the patient into a parasympathetic state, which means relaxed state where the body can heal, where it can detox, where it can do all the things that it needs to do, and that includes the brain. So when we're talking about addiction, I think meditation is very, and mindfulness is far underutilized in our treatment system. There are plenty of studies with different types of meditation and what that does with the autonomic nervous system. So I think that's a very big piece, and I believe in that mind-body connection. I think that we should do more and have more studies along that line. But there's enough now, study-wise, and also those of us working in the field, we know it. We see it. If you don't address that root problem, that root cause of anxiety and depression and all the things that can underlie addiction to start with, then you're kind of missing the boat. But there are some interesting treatments and things that I'll talk about today on the line of outside of that mind-body piece, but it's a very, very big piece, and I don't want to, I want to let that be known right up front. I think that's one of the biggest pieces.
Yeah, it's a good point. There's a lot of literature to show that transcendental meditation, recent studies on yoga, these things do calm and soothe the mind, and they give you a certain degree of clarity and freedom and space so that in response to cravings and urges and triggers and pain, the mindfulness and the stillness practices really give you that freedom to see what's going on and give you the capacity to choose maybe a more loving way to address your pain than numbing it with addiction. I completely agree with you. Exactly.
Yes. And I think another underutilized part, and, you know, I do, I developed a course, a master's level course for the social work department at Arizona State University, where we I teach physicians and social workers, those that are at least at that master's level and beyond, about ancient healing traditions in modern day. And they all have to be science-based. And so there's a lot there that we can learn. Another underutilized piece is music alone. Studies on meditation music with methamphetamine, studies with rats, these are newer studies that I'm talking about. And we know that during detoxification in the detox units, there have been studies with randomized studies, cluster groups of patients there, and using music and music therapy and how beneficial it is. And songwriting itself. Songwriting tends to target the states of shame and guilt and pride in adults with substance use disorders. And these have been studied in the detox units and outside of that as well. So I love music. I think it's a great, safe way for people to tap into their emotions, be it joy, be it fear, whatever it is, and allow a safe environment for them to do some personal work. And I'm a very, very big fan of music, and not just music therapy, because music therapy is with the therapist, but music alone, music that's being studied now in our cancer patients and, you know, with brain pathologies, and how music can take us to that state where the brain is in that what we'd say homeostatic state, where it can start kind of analyzing life and yourself and just mindfulness. Sometimes if we tell people to go meditate, they go, I can't quiet my brain. I can't do it. And that causes more stress. But with music, it just can kind of take you there in those different emotional states without having to really work at it. So I think I would love to see, and there are more and more studies coming out with music and addiction. And that's an area that I'm very excited about as well.
Very exciting, yes. You know, when I work with patients, Dr. Warden, on dealing with cravings and when they're upset, I work with them on ways to soothe and distract themselves. And it's really true that if you're very upset or if you're having cravings, one of the ways of soothing and distracting yourself is to listen to music that you love, and to do so in a particular way, which is to listen to the music in sort of a meditative or mindful way, where you just focus your attention on each note or on different instruments maybe that are playing in a band or on a voice, and really, really bring your attention over and over again back to the sound, to the sound, to the sound. That can be very, very soothing and calming, I agree.
Correct. And, you know, even studies with schizophrenics, they say if they're in a psychotic state, you can't put on relaxing music at that moment. You have to take that music where they're at. So it might be maybe even rock music, but then you can use that music to de-escalate them out of the psychosis. I might give a shout-out to a book, The Secret Language of the Heart by Barry Goldstein. He works with a lot of the self-help New York Times bestselling authors, Dr. Daniel Amen, psychiatrist, and he's teaching in the book, has a lot of the scientific studies about music and how it's being utilized with different, you know, medical conditions. But it's very interesting in that teaching that you have a playlist. If you want to feel joy in the moment, what are the songs? That's your joy playlist. If you want to feel more relaxed or for insomnia, that you create those playlists with music that does that to you as a person. Your song may not be the same as mine. You know, my happy song may be very different than your happy song. But the book is a good read and a good way to use sound and music, you know, as tools just for those personal transformations that can happen. So I think that might be something that your listeners might enjoy along the lines of this music discussion.
Wonderful suggestion. So we have meditation, we have stillness practices, yoga, those kinds of things. We have music. Wonderful, wonderful suggestions. What else would you suggest?
Well, I think one that, I mean, we all know about exercise from HIIT to yoga. We understand that they've looked at that high-intensity interval circuit training, especially with substance abuse, and there's some protocols that are being put through right now with major universities, and it's looking like that particular type of exercise, either that or a Zen restorative quiet yoga, both extremes are really looking good. It's the stuff in between getting on an hour on a treadmill that may not be working as well. So it's that interval training where you're pushing hard and you slow down, you push down, slow down, 6 minutes a day, that type of exercise, has been working really well. And, of course, yoga is always good because it's the mind-body. It's de-stressing. But I think it's interesting to know that people need to understand there's different types. And, again, just like with the music, what do you want to do? Are you in a depressed mood? Do you need to motivate yourself? Do you need that? Then the interval training may be the thing to do that day. But if you're already tired, if you're, you know, you just can't, you know, you feel high strung already and you want to calm down a little bit, that's the time for the yoga practice. So it's not one or the other. It's what do you need in that moment, and learning to identify within yourself what it is you need in that moment. What time?
Very good. Yeah, there's multiple studies that show that exercise, like you said, interval training, cardio,
right.
getting high cardio rate, and mm-hmm. also resistance training, weightlifting.
Yes.
Both of those can reduce stress, anxiety, and depression. And as we know, with addiction, addiction is often driven by pain. And
right.
and if you can reduce the pain, then you reduce the compulsion to addict.
Correct.
Yes, very good.
Complete agreement. So a couple of other things that I think are very interesting, you know, talking about diet, we know that lipid alterations, so those cholesterol, those fats, have been identified with psychosis and adolescence. And so we know that there's something there with these phospholipids or those. But an interesting new study that literally was just published, I think, in May of this year, is the ketogenic diet. Now, we are working with that with cancer patients and also with brain pathologies. It was originally discovered for, you know, epilepsy. And now we're seeing very good effect in Alzheimer's and ADD, ADHD, many other things. But that new study just came out. Now, this was a study on rats, but it was showing that it diminished the behavioral responses in cocaine-addicted rats. So the studies were showing that high-fat, good fats, the good oils, the good fats, that high-fat diet suggests that it's really impacting the dopamine-mediated behaviors and may be a very good therapy for drug addiction or other types of addiction. So we'll see more and more as that comes out. We've been looking at different pathologies with it. But I was excited to see this one come out because it was out of a neuroscience program at Hartford, Connecticut, and to see that it was a particular study on addiction. And I'm a big fan of the ketogenic done the correct way, and that's a big if. Done the correct way in helping many brain pathologies, and I have seen it in my own practice help with addiction behaviors.
So tell our listeners about what are good fats and bad fats, and how do we do a ketogenic diet the correct way?
There is so much online now that said, you know, a year ago we didn't have much, but there's so many books, there are so many, so much direction online. But in general, in a nutshell, a ketogenic diet is a high-fat diet. It is not Atkins, which was a high-protein diet. This is lower protein. If we're treating cancer, we've got patients on 70 to 75% fat. Very little protein and no carbs, no sugar. Now, when we're working with addiction, we've got to look at that in a different way. But the point is, if we get into ketosis, which means the body's using fat as its fuel instead of sugar and carbs and other things. So if it doesn't have that, it's going to turn to fat. And guess what the brain's favorite fuel is? Fat. It runs very efficiently and very well on fat. So good oils are avocados, raw nuts and seeds, olive oil, all those kinds of fats that are known to be in coconut oil, medium chain triglycerides. So the ketogenic diet, I think, in addiction and these addiction pathologies, I think, I can't wait to see some more studies. But I have seen this work with my patients, no matter what the brain pathology is or what they're struggling with, they feel better. The brain works better. It just does a great job. We've gotten in America way too high on our carbs and our sugars, and by decreasing those, it makes big changes.
Yeah. So one of the things that you're saying is that when you get really rushes of carbs with sugar and processed foods, that can destabilize the brain and promote the risk of addicting? Is that your thought?
Very much so, and there are studies showing that. We know about sugar. We know about stimulants. You know, we know about cocaine and the pathologies and the whole pathways that those run through. So now we're knowing, okay, what does the brain really like as a fuel? Now, there's some vitamins and minerals I'll talk about in a minute that have studies that can help, but I will tell you that by working just with the diet alone can make very big changes, and getting rid of the junk and putting in the good oils and the good fats and the good fuel. So I love the idea of especially if we've got real addiction going on in detox. You're not hungry, you feel good, and I would love to see the ketogenic diet implemented in some of the detox facilities. And I think we're close to that. I think we may be able to start doing that fairly soon, and that will be very interesting. And, you know, anything that changes the microbiome, and that microbiome is that whole, all the bugs, you know, we're mostly made out of bugs. People get upset when they realize that most of us is a bunch of bugs. It's not who we think is us. Our DNA is about, you know, 2 to 4%. So we've got to be nice to those bugs. That's where probiotics, all those things come in, but also eating differently. And there are studies on changing the microbiome, working with the opioid receptors, with the brain pathologies, with addiction. So we are studying the microbiome for cancer quite a bit, and also for Alzheimer's, for any Parkinson's. And so the ketogenic diet is along that line. But I'm excited, too, that this pathophysiology, like depression, anxiety, addiction, impulsivity, all of that, looking at the studies that are showing us that by changing the microbiome, that ratio of bugs in our gut, very, very important, because the nervous system, it's called the enteric nervous system. You probably talked about this on your show, and bring it back up. The enteric nervous system around that GI has more neurons than the spinal cord, almost as many as the brain, but it's a very important nervous system. And that brain-gut connection is very big. I've been lecturing on this for 20 years. I would be in a big classroom with psychiatrists and psychologists, and I'd say, where is serotonin made or modulated? Where is most of the serotonin made and modulated? And everybody would say, hypothalamus, pituitary, you know, in the brain. We'd say, nope, 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 it's in the gut. I think most people at this point know that, but your listeners need to know that that gut, if your gut is not working well, your immune system is compromised, and your neurochemistry, your brain chemistry, can't modulate itself, and you can't even make a lot of the neuropeptides and the hormones that you need to for things to work well. So the first place I start with somebody that comes with addiction, I start looking at their gut health. And when we start fixing that with their diet and looking at the causes of why that gut's not working well, the brain starts working better.
Very good. So we have meditation, we have music, we have exercise, we have ketogenic diet, we have helping with the microbiome. Tell me, how can our audience improve their microbiome? What do they need to do in terms of diet and other interventions to improve their gut microbiome?
So, you know, pre and probiotics are good. We know that fermented foods, kefir, kimchi, those kinds of things, you have to be careful how they're prepared, because they can cause problems and be processed incorrectly. But those kind of fermented foods, and even just taking a probiotic supplement, I recommend rotating those, because you're going to get different bugs. We know some of the bugs and exactly where they work, but a lot of them we still don't know enough. And until we really know which bugs you want for what conditions, rotate them. That means you buy one product this month, and next month maybe try a different one. That way you're kind of populating your bugs in the gut. And we know that the more diverse, that means the more different bugs you've got in your gut, the better off you are, from your brain to your immune system to your overall health. So diversity is big. And eating different foods, eating dark green leafy vegetables, all the things that we know are healthy. And, of course, decreasing the bad things. Sugar disrupts the microbiome. You know, all the bad foods that we have, the neurotoxins in sodas and the artificial sweeteners, those affect the microbiome in a negative way. So just cleaning up the diet alone helps the bugs, the good bugs in that gut, be able to function the way they're supposed to be.
So if we eat healthy and maybe do some rotating probiotics and focus on fermented foods, and if we eat healthy and avoid putting unhealthy foods, then our microbiome is better and we feel better. And if we feel better, then we're in less pain, and then we're at less risk of addicting. Is that your thought?
That's correct. And it decreases the inflammation. So you decrease inflammation, you decrease the pain. And if you are making more serotonin and dopamine, and you're able to modulate it, that means it's going where it's supposed to go for the brain to be where it's supposed to be, and balancing these things, then we're working on everything about the brain. The behaviors that we have, the addictions that we have, all of those things get better. So that brain-gut connection is very big. And so I'm excited that now, and I went to Boston and L.A. this year to this big different microbiome conferences with researchers from all over the world. And you will be hearing more and more and more, and your listeners will be hearing about the microbiome. And very big area of research, and we're just realizing how important that brain-gut connection is. I have to say, Dr. Mike, though, as a naturopathic medical doctor, day one of our school is health begins in the gut. Everything, your skin, everything kind of starts and relies there. It's much more important than we've ever thought.
Wow, this is so, so good. Very, very important. Yes, we really need to look at what we are made of what we eat, right? That is so important that we be mindful. And my thought is that we really have to change our eating agenda to eating in terms of what is healthy and good for us rather than eating for pleasure per se. I mean, we can enjoy the pleasure of food.
Sure.
But we have to be intentional about making sure that we're eating foods that are also healthy for us at the same time.
Correct.
Yeah. Well, you're listening to the Well Mind with Dr. Mike show. We have with us a naturopathic physician, Dr. Donice Warden, who is with us talking about alternative approaches to recovery. This has been a great discussion so far, Dr. Warden. And everybody, please stay tuned. We'll be right back with you after this break.
The Bright Side of Talk, HealthyLife.net.
Welcome back to the Well Mind with Dr. Mike show. This is Dr. Michael McGee with you, and today we have as our guest Dr. Donice Warden, who is a naturopathic physician, and we're talking about alternative ways to heal addiction. Welcome back, Dr. Warden.
Thank you.
So this has been great. We've been talking about a lot of different things. What else do you have for us that if we're suffering from addiction, that we can do to help heal ourselves?
Right. So, you know, a question that we get a lot of is, you know, which supplements, are there any that are evidence-based that we know may really help? And I will say there are a few. At a meta-analysis of looking at a lot of data, I think everyone agrees in most of the studies that these, they're called PUFAs, you know, they're the good, they're kind of the good polyunsaturated fats. So, again, on that ketogenic, but omega-3s, fish oil, very, very good. I think that there's a lot of science behind it. The folate, which is a B vitamin, but it needs to be a methylated folate because a lot of people have a gene where if you take a regular B vitamin, a regular folate, it can make you worse. And psychiatrists now understand this. They're testing the MTHFR gene, and I do this on all my patients because if we have that gene, then you shouldn't be taking a regular B vitamin to make things worse for you. You need methylated folate. That has a lot of study behind it, especially in major depressive disorders. And now, as far as mood disorders, schizophrenia, anything like that, NAC, N-acetylcysteine, is a very good adjunctive treatment for these patients. Those are ones that have a lot of studies behind them that have been looked at in addiction and mood disorders. Others would be vitamin D. Vitamin D being low has been associated with many brain pathologies and actually has been studied in the cognitive functions and the mental health status under methadone maintenance treatment. So they really studied vitamin D, which, by the way, is a hormone, mostly a hormone, not a vitamin. And most patients I test are low in vitamin D. And I'm in Arizona. We're in the sun all the time. So it's not that. We think something may be blocking it environmentally. We're not quite sure. But almost everyone we test is low in vitamin D unless they're taking it. Vitamin C has good research behind it. Zinc and magnesium, those are wonderful minerals. And again, specifically been looked at with addiction. Magnesium helps the heart. It helps us relax. Zinc helps our immune system. So these are things that help a lot of things, not just going after addiction. And then the peptides, and now those are like proteins. You know, there's different ones. There's serine, there's thionine, there's a bunch of them. But what I do is do a white blood cell test. And so we take a patient, we take their blood, and their white blood cells, not the red blood cells, but the immune system white blood cells, are grown in a dish for a few weeks at a specialty lab, and we know is there any nutrient deficiency? A vitamin, a mineral, a protein, a essential fatty acid, omega 3, 6, 9, tells me the inflammatory markers. I get a real good look at what's getting absorbed. You can be eating or taking supplements and still not getting the absorption and the assimilation of it. So this test allows us to see what's getting inside the cells. Then I look at the patient and say, what are we dealing with? What are they struggling with? And which of those deficiencies really fit in helping that patient? Very specific in what I recommend. It's not just everybody take everything and I hope something works. The shotgun approach, I don't think is good medicine. I've got to have a real reason and a real, a logical decision of why I would put somebody on a nutrient. But without having that test, without knowing it, I would say most of your listeners should be thinking about taking an omega-3 fish oil. Make sure you're asking for a certificate of analysis to make sure anything you take every day is tested. That means the company tested to make sure it doesn't have heavy metals in it or aflatoxins. Those are kind of things that grow in there that shouldn't be growing in there. So you're testing the quality of it. But vitamin D, omega-3s, that in general is going to be good for most people, and I would feel comfortable with N-acetylcysteine and zinc and magnesium and vitamin C, if you know, without knowing. Those are just good ones. And if you get a really good multivitamin, a lot of those things are already in there.
Right. You know, let me tell you, in my practice, practically, I can't do a WBC test culture, and I can't always check for a genetic analysis. So what I recommend for my patients is to take 2 grams of fish oil twice a day, a multivitamin, and 2,000 units of vitamin D, just as a general practice. What do you think of that? Is that reasonable for our listeners?
I think that's reasonable, but I will tell you that most people are if you're just taking 2,000 IUs of vitamin D, they may still be deficient, and they'll never get up to where it should be unless they load it. That means, and they can get a regular vitamin D test, 25-hydroxy, from any physician, right? And then sometimes you have to load it to 10,000 international units for a month. But here's the catch. Vitamin D by itself is not good for the body. It can cause calcification. That means, carotid artery problems, this and that. So we load them to where we get them where they're supposed to be, but the maintenance dose, when we figure that out, and it's usually 4,000 to 6,000 IUs, we put vitamin D and K together, and a good supplement will have those together. So without knowing any information about yourself, vitamin D and K together is my recommendation, never vitamin D alone. We need to do things the way nature told us and made it. When we start doing monotherapies or one thing at a time is where we can get into trouble.
That is so helpful. Thank you for that advice.
Sure.
I'll share with you that there is some research, limited research, showing that NAC, N-acetylcysteine, is helpful for cannabis addiction in adolescents. And it's very helpful for other compulsive behaviors. For example, it's helpful for skin picking or hair pulling, which are compulsive behaviors. NAC is helpful for those. I just don't think the research has been done yet to really look, and it should be, to look at how NAC might be helpful for other addictive disorders. But I appreciate you raising that as a possibility. If people are really experiencing strong compulsions, NAC might be something to try.
I really agree. There was a mouse study that they did look on opiate addiction and withdrawal in that 3-week detox period, and it looked very promising and very good. It's also been looked at for alcohol dependence. So, again, the more studies and more of us that are saying, let's keep looking at this, I think that we know that the body does well when it's given something that it considers good for itself. It's going to help the body kind of repair itself. And these are naturally found in foods. It's just we usually don't eat enough of it or get enough of it. Or we have that leaky gut, that compromised gut, that you just can't break things down, even your good food. You just can't break it down and assimilate it and get it where it's supposed to be. Acetyl L-carnitine, NAC, those are all wonderful ones. But again, if you can't break it down and assimilate it, you need to go to someone that knows how to heal your gut for you, and then all these things can really start helping.
So one thought that comes to mind for our listeners is, if you're sober and if you're doing all these other things that you mentioned, and if you're really you're really taking good care of yourself, and if you don't feel healthy, vital, and vibrant, then maybe you should see a naturopathic physician like yourself to do some of these WBC tests and genetic tests and look at whether supplements might help you. Is that sound right to you?
I agree. Again, fix the gut. We say if we get people sleeping and pooping, you've gone a long ways toward health.
Well, thank you, Dr. Warden. This is the Well Mind with Dr. Mike show. Dr. Michael McGee here with you, and our guest, Dr. Donice Warden, talking about alternative ways to heal from addiction. We'll be right back after this break.
You're listening to HealthyLife.net, the radio network that brings positive talk with positive change to make your world a little better.
Welcome back to the Well Mind with Dr. Mike show. Dr. Michael McGee here with you. And today we have Dr. Donice Warden, a naturopathic physician, talking with us about alternative ways to heal from addiction. Welcome back, Dr. Warden.
Thank you, Dr. Mike.
We just had a great discussion. Yeah, we have covered a lot. A great discussion just about supplements. And so just curious, what else do you have for us?
Sure. Well, let's talk in this section a little bit about hormones, and I think another area that maybe is a little overlooked. There are some newer studies that have been coming out in behavioral neuroscience journals looking at, you know, we know that women, it's very interesting, that women become addicted sooner after initiating cocaine use as compared to men. So everyone started looking and saying, why is that? Why are they more vulnerable in this? And the findings, they started looking at rat studies and trying to look at hormones and taking ovaries out, and came to the thought that estrogen, and now we know progesterone, these hormones really do play into some of our behaviors, our addiction initiations, the way that we have the associated cues, and the motivational features of addiction. So all of those have been looked at. And one of the studies is interesting. They gave tamoxifen, which is a cancer drug that we give to block estrogen, that when we know certain cancers get fed by those estrogens, tamoxifen is one of those what we call aromatase inhibitors that blocks it. So the studies they were looking at for addiction, and this one of the studies, it was a cocaine addiction in mice, they were looking at what happens if we give them tamoxifen. And it helped. It helped, helped with the drug-associated cues, extinction of getting rid of those, and the development of motivational features. So it was allowing it, when they motivated them, it worked better. It didn't, however, in that one particular study, impair the relapse amounts. But what it did was allow them to go better in other ways in that hypothesis. That's just one study. But in looking at hormones, we're seeing that progesterone, estrogen, they play into that. And more studies will be done on that. But in the meantime, for your listeners, is that, again, having a hormone panel run. Is your testosterone too high and it's not converting to free testosterone because you're too low in vitamin D and you can't convert it, so it's stuck in total testosterone and you're angry and you're irritable and you're short? These things can help balance the way that we feel, and when that's better, as you have been talking, and what you well know is that when those things are better, the addiction is not as great of a pull because you just feel more balanced and better. So looking at, there's three different estrogens. You look at the testosterone, is it converting? Progesterone, look at DHEA. And here's the piece that I tell all my patients. DHEA is the beginning hormone that makes all of those other sex hormones, all the hormones that will make us crazier or will help us balance and feel better. When they are balanced, and hormones are powerful, powerful substances. So when they're balanced, we're balanced. When they're not, we're not going to feel ourselves. But DHEA, that beginning hormone, that is made a couple different places in the body, but especially for postmenopausal women, when the ovaries are starting to shut down and it doesn't do as much in testes in men, that starts dropping. When DHEA is lower, all the hormones start coming down, and you feel different. There's fatigue, there's irritability. And I would love to see us do more studies, in particular with recovery, and what's happening there with the hormones. What's happening during, you know, before when they come in, but when you go through the detox, when you're doing that, what's happening hormonal-wise, and can we support people better? And it doesn't mean that we throw everybody on the hormone. It means that there are ways to help balance those hormones. Some of them we've been talking about, meditation, exercise, some of the nutraceuticals. Sometimes we might need a hormone. We really might if it's incredibly low. But I have seen patients do far better with all of the pathologies when their hormones are balanced. And I think we need to take a lot deeper dive in looking at that.
So, yes, treating low testosterone can really make a huge difference in men and women, actually, who have subclinical levels.
That's right.
What about for women who are in menopause? Is treating the estrogen and progesterone levels, any evidence that affects rates of recovery from addiction at all?
Well, that's what that study was trying to do, the mouse study, when they were put tamoxifen. So they took out they did an ovarectomy on the rats. They took their estrogen out, I mean their ovaries out, so that they couldn't produce that estradiol to see if that would kind of decrease the vulnerability. That was their hypothesis. They looked at it. They didn't see it decrease the relapse just in that one study, but it did. It did work on extinguishing a lot of the negative things that come out of that, the learning, the extinction of the drug cues, that, you know, you have something that happens and you immediately want to go back and do, you know, whatever your addiction is. So it it helped with motivational things when they were giving motivational, if you do this, that it worked better. So they found in that study, because, again, they looked back and they said, why is it that women become addicted sooner than men with initiating cocaine? And they've looked at it with others. So they said it's got to be a hormonal difference. So, yes, postmenopausal women, they're already can be turning into a little bit of a wreck because the hormones are changing. They can feel it, you notice it, and balancing that is very big. But the way you balance that, in my book, is going back to the adrenal glands. Those are the glands that sit on top of the kidneys. They're the ones that are the stress, produce the stress hormones, cortisol, adrenaline, you know, grab the car and take it off the baby, those powerful stress hormones. So when you're in an anxiety state, when you are in these states that make you run from the bear, and it could be something you love doing, but it could also be something fearful. But when you are pushing and you ask those adrenal glands to make all those stress hormones, they go, okay, because there's a bear and we need to survive, but guess what? They shut down. They shut down the production of DHEA, that hormone that makes all the hormones that make us feel better. That drops, so now our hormones are not there for us. And it affects the GI, the gastrointestinal, and we just had that discussion of the brain-gut connection. So the adrenal glands, the stress hormone, those little guys need to be helped and supported and worked on and come back into more of a balance.
I see. So practically speaking, what can our listeners do for their adrenal glands or for their hormones,
right,
other than correcting testosterone? Any general practical recommendations?
Yes, getting to the parasympathetic state. That means the relaxed state. Now we're back to the music, to the meditation, to the exercise, to the, the practice of finding your joy and your passion in life. When you're in...
Those help balance your hormones then.
That's right. And sleeping. Sleeping is huge. So balancing hormones, all of those things, when we do that and we tell the body there's not a bear that it needs to run from, a lot of wonderful repair and balance happens in the body.
Very good. You're listening to the Well Mind with Dr. Mike show with Dr. Donnie Warden with us, talking about alternative approaches to healing from addiction. Stay tuned. We'll be right back after this break.
Information, entertainment, worldwide. HealthyLife.net.
Welcome back to the Well Mind with Dr. Mike show. Dr. Michael McGee here with you. Today, our guest is Dr. Donnie Warden. We're talking about alternative approaches to healing from addiction. Welcome back, Dr. Warden.
Thank you, Dr. Mike.
That was a great discussion about hormones and before that about supplements. I'm wondering if you'd like to talk a little bit about maybe homeopathy and acupuncture.
Sure. You know, just to tag a little bit on our last discussion about the stress response, is that acupuncture has been shown that it attenuates relapse to drug-seeking behavior because it inhibits the stress response, and those are in studies. So these, sometimes they're regular acupuncture, so you just get the little dots in your ear and it just continues, and drug addiction has been shown to be, has really helped prevent the high rate of relapse into the drug-seeking behavior. So I want people to kind of think about that and explore that, that acupuncture really helps that stress-related drug relapse. And something that they might want to explore that's inexpensive and it can be helpful. And it's ancient, it's still around, you know, after thousands of years, and there's a reason why acupuncture and Chinese medicine is still around us. It works in many instances. So that would be something for your listeners to consider.
I agree, and I'll tell you clinically, I sometimes use a device called the Bridge, which is an electrical mm-hmm. acupuncture device.
Right.
And I've seen extraordinary results with that. There is good clinical data to show that this FDA-approved device and acupuncture around the ears can
right.
virtually eliminate detox symptoms, especially from opiates.
That's right.
And it's really extraordinary, underappreciated, very, very effective technique. So I appreciate you mentioning that.
Well, and I agree with that. I work a lot with cold lasers and frequency medicine. That's one of my areas of expertise that I really, really enjoy and like. And that is far underutilized in that electrical acupuncture, working with the frequency or the electrical part of the body. We are a big battery. We really are. And that's a whole other discussion for a whole other show. However, again, underappreciated and undervalued. And I think, and again, not having side effects is a great way and something to think about. Something outside of that that is also a little outside of the standard of care box is homeopathy. Now, you know, it really, it's a matter of confrontation in a lot of medical circles, but it's been around for a long time as well. And again, because it has no side effects, it doesn't contraindicate any treatments or any medications. In Italy and in other countries where I have studied, France and in Europe, there's a large percentage of the population that utilizes homeopathy for everything, including, you know, the royal family has used it for centuries. But as far as addiction and behavior, there are studies that have been done, mostly out of Europe, but they are utilizing it. We're using it in the cancer facilities there, the integrative cancer treatment places. But it's interesting that now it is being studied for depression, anxiety, and addiction and other mental disorders. And how homeopathy works is you take something that that would generally cause a symptom. So one of the studies, and this will explain it better, was that they did a certain potency for a rehab facility, and they used opium and in one, and then another remedy, another medicine, was coca, which is from the coca leaf. So if you were taking cocaine or you were taking opium, the symptoms that that would cause when you dilute it down into a homeopathic preparation into that medicine, now it takes away those symptoms. So it's being utilized and has been, and those are within the scope of my practice. It's part of a license that I'm allowed to do. I'm licensed in homeopathy, but many practitioners aren't. You know, you have to look at those, but in the hands of someone who understands homeopathy, it's kind of one of those things, what you say, it's inexpensive. It's usually $10 for a whole bottle of, you know, of these little pills, and they're either going to work or they're not. And when it does, it's astonishingly amazing in how it can work. So I think, again, I'd love to see more studies, but it's hard to get the studies out of something that's inexpensive. It's not an expensive drug, but I have seen it work in my practice, and I do utilize homeopathy.
Well, thank you for that. I'm a little skeptical about homeopathy because
yeah.
I'm fairly familiar with the addictions literature, and I've never seen
right.
a good placebo-controlled, double-blind, randomized controlled trial of homeopathy showing any benefit for addiction. But we live in a world where we live in a world where we have to balance evidence-based treatments with also our clinical experience. So. I'm skeptical but open-minded that maybe there might be, but it sounds like we probably need the research to show, right?
Understood. And I, you know, for addiction, yes. There were about three studies that were, you know, four that I found that were in particular about addiction. Some were not placebo-controlled. They're out of Europe. But there are placebo-controlled studies for homeopathy. I do injectables. They are FDA-registered. We do injectables of certain things. There's one in particular for depression, for mild depression, that the FDA has allowed us to use, and it works really well. So homeopathy is hard to prove. It's hard to look at, as far as a research standpoint. But clinically, it's been used for, hundreds of years, and with no side effects. Sometimes you say this makes sense from a practitioner that's been trained in it, that really understands the medicine itself. So that's something,
right. Again,
that people might think about trying. Again, it won't interfere with anything else that you're doing with them, Dr. Mike. It's not going to interfere. It's not going to have a side effect or a contraindication. So, again, something that is just to be aware of, and we'll keep a watch and see if there's more analysis comes out.
Well, very, very good. Well, you've covered a lot of ground here today, and I think what comes to mind for me is that the approaches that you're suggesting really have to do with balancing and calming and soothing and just maximizing the vitality of the mind-body system in all these different ways.
The body is amazing. The brain is amazing. It's just a miracle in itself. And never giving up hope and saying it's too late, or I've done too much damage, or my brain is hurt, or my addiction has gone through the family, or I've destroyed myself. It is always giving hope and understanding the body does miraculous things all the time. Give it what it needs, the good nutrition, the good, practice of things that you're doing that are good in your life, and take out what it doesn't. And that means bad food, bad habits, all of that, and the body will and can heal.
What a message of hope. Dr. Warden, it has been a real pleasure to have you on my show, and I know that our listeners have greatly benefited from what you've offered. Thank you so much for joining us and sharing your wisdom and experience with us.
Thank you, Dr. Mike. I appreciate your work and what you're doing and the book that you have written. Very important work.
How can our listeners reach you and learn about your work?
Probably the best, my website is drwarden, drwarden, at me.com, or the office number is 480-588-2233.
Okay, very good. Thank you again. Thank you, listeners. It's great to have you again this month, and we'll see you next month. Be well and take care.